Are you allowed to be your own engineer?
We have to be our own engineers.
Oh, it's a rule.
It's
right,
a rule. They even pay us extra to do it.
Oh. I thought that would cause jurisdictional problems.
No, they bought out the technicians union. We've gone from 44 technicians when I first came here 20 years ago to 5.
Jesus.
This is in radio primarily, and they're reducing them in all of the areas as the equipment becomes miniaturized.
Yeah.
Actually, they haven't miniaturized any of our equipment. We're using the same facilities here that we used 20 years ago, same board. Same tape recorders,
right.
So it's not really set up to do a combo operation, so you have to run back and forth. They do have microphones in the studios, in the control rooms now, but it's not convenient. There's no place for the guests to sit, and it's very awkward. You have to wear earphones and all of that, so it's better just to roll it,
right.
And it comes out all right.
Right.
But and it's better, too, because sometimes the technician, he was busy with his racing form, crossword puzzles, or he was talking to his bookie or his broker on the telephone when you're trying to do an interview. Or if you're out on a story, they would sometimes say, well, it's my lunch break. And they say, no, you can't leave. The mayor's coming.
Right.
He's going to write the announcement at any minute. No, they go on their lunch break. Well, I saw you last at the Trinity Book Fair.
Right.
I assume that you have a daughter there.
I do. My younger daughter's there, yeah.
What grade is she in?
She's a junior. And the older ones in college.
Well, that worked out nicely for you to be a volunteer, parental volunteer.
Yeah, I was doing the same thing I would have done if I hadn't been a volunteer. We'll go around and look at the books.
Did you
I had to do was push a cart.
Did you see any of your own books there?
No.
Shame on them.
Well, no, that's good. That means you can't find them. Right?
Well, you want people to find your books.
Well, the old books are hard to find, and that was all old books. I very rarely see any of my books.
What was your first book?
An Education in Georgia. It was about the first two black undergraduates at the University of Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Sounds serious.
It was pretty serious. There were some funny moments in it. It was done. It was in the New Yorker in 63, I think, and it came out as a book in 64.
Mm-hmm.
It was the longest piece I ever did for the New Yorker. The only multi-part piece.
You're still a staff writer for the New Yorker.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly? You know, when I think of a staff person, it's somebody who comes with all sorts of benefits and this sort of thing, but I heard somewhere somebody said, well, being a staff writer isn't really like that at the New Yorker. It's like the right of first refusal or something.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Whoever said that had it mixed up with a fiction contract. A fiction contract in New Yorker gives the New Yorker the right of first refusal on fiction. And anything that's not fact is considered fiction. So, for instance, what Thurber wrote or what Garrison Keillor writes would be considered fiction, what the New Yorker calls casuals. That's a completely separate thing. I've never known what a staff writer meant.
Does it mean a regular paycheck?
No, indeed.
No?
No.
Well, see, a staff person is supposed to get a... I don't know. I'm a staff employee of CBS as opposed to a lot of freelancers that we have, or per diems, people who do drop-ins on shows, this sort of thing. But I'm
well, it's an odd arrangement at the New Yorker because the only people who were ever on salary as writers, I think, when I first got there in 63, there were talk reporters who were on salaries, talk-of-the-town reporters, who were on very small salaries, and none of the ones I knew did talk at the town stories. I don't think any of them did talk at the town stories. They were being paid for that, but one of them was working on fiction, and the other one was writing casuals, and the other one was working on trying to get a long fact piece done. But New Yorker writers have always been paid by the piece. And it's very interesting when people talk about the luxury of being given all this time to finish a piece. You do have as long as you want to. It's just that it's your time. It's just wonderful when they say, God, these spoiled writers, the ones who are given 6 or 8 months to finish a piece. You're given forever to finish a piece. It's eternal. It's just that you only get paid for it once. And if you have some kind of trust fund and you want to take 12 years to do it, it's up to you. I've never been sure how to draw the line between people who occasionally do pieces for the New Yorker and staff writers, some of whom do very few pieces. It's not offices, I don't think. Some people who have offices aren't, and some people who are don't have offices.
They ought to call you like a contributing writer or contributing editor or something, don't you think?
They don't call us anything. I mean, it's never been a masthead, so they don't exactly call us anything. But I've always decided the only way to, in an American corporation, decide who's on the staff and who isn't is who's on the medical plan. And if you're on the medical plan, as far as I'm concerned, you're a staff writer, and if you're not, you're not.
Do you have an office there?
I do, yeah.
Do you use it?
I use it some, but I write mainly at home. I don't like to come uptown.
Yeah, you get a nosebleed.
Yeah, I know.
Above 14th Street.
Yeah, I know. I've been above 14th Street, but I'm above 14th Street now. I've been to Connecticut even, but I don't do it regularly.
Of course, when you go to Connecticut, you have to dress pretty warmly. It's cool that far north.
Yeah, I mean, this is on the way to Connecticut, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I was visiting Ved Mehta a while back at the New Yorker. I'd never seen the offices before, and. In some respects, Ved Mehta, as you know, is sightless, and he hasn't missed anything by looking at those offices. They're a little gloomy.
I always said they look like the branch office of a failing insurance company. I do think they're a little gloomy, but on the other hand, the remarkable thing about the offices at the New Yorker is not that they're not flashy, but that they exist. I mean, why do writers have offices at the New Yorker? No other magazine gives writers offices, writers who maybe technically don't even work for the New Yorker. So it seemed to me that everybody looks at it in kind of the opposite way that they should. It's not a question of why they're not flashy. The question, the remarkable thing, is that a whole group of writers and artists and even fiction writers, if I think in some cases, are given offices to work in, even though they may do a lot of work that doesn't have anything to do with the New Yorker. Dwight McDonald had the office two down from me for the first 10 or 15 years I was there. I don't think he, except for his review of the Harrington book on The Other America, I'm not sure if he ever did a piece that whole time at the New Yorker.
Well, if I had an office there, I'd use it for storage. You know, I have to rent a storage room in a warehouse uptown. You know, it's $63 a month to do that. Be better to store the stuff at the New Yorker in the office.
Yeah. Well, I keep a lot of files there. Keep may be too grand a word for what I do with files, but there are a lot of files in my office.
What's the atmosphere like with the exit of William Shawn?
I don't know. I've barely been there for the last 4 months. I mean, I go away in the summer, and I've been away since I got back. So the last piece I closed, which is when I'm there most steadily, day after day, I closed from Nova Scotia in June. So it's really been months since I've been there any more than kind of to pick up my mail and say hello. But it seems fine. I mean, it's obviously more informal because Bob Gottlieb's a more informal person. And I think people tend to, in some ways, take their cue from whoever's supposedly in charge of an organization. Although in the New Yorker, that doesn't mean anything exactly because there isn't any... I don't think there's ever been a meeting or anything like that at the New Yorker. So it,
a lot more sneakers.
No, everybody always dressed like that at the New Yorker.
Did they?
Except for Mr. Shawn. I mean, the younger guys did. I think that I've never seen any of the younger writers at the New Yorker in a coat and tie.
You didn't sign that petition, did you?
Sure.
You signed the one asking Gottlieb not to join?
Sure.
Why?
Well, I thought that it was an imperfect instrument. I mean, I would have much preferred a letter to Newhouse saying that he had broken several promises and that what he had done was basically crude and kind of stupid. But it just turned out that that wasn't what most people wanted to do. And I thought the notice had to be taken in some way. I didn't have any doubt about the outcome. I think I said publicly at a meeting that the worst thing could happen is that Bob Gottlieb would say, okay, you know, I won't come, because it certainly wasn't directed against him. I mean, many of us knew him and liked him, and I think it said in the letter it wasn't directed against him. But I think that if someone says, I agree not to choose a new editor without meeting with the editorial department, and then doesn't, that you shouldn't just let it pass. I mean, of course, the wise heads would say, well, that's just what we call in the newspaper business the usual Murdoch assurances. And that may be, but I think then they should be known as the usual Murdoch and Newhouse assurances. I mean, I think that people should scream and shout if they don't like something, even if it's the way it's done. I mean, why not?
Well, you have a lot more independence over there in New York than we do at CBS here. They say, you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. That's all there is. They don't approach us and give us options.
Well, that's true. I think that that in any organization, that if people don't like what happens, and I particularly in the organizations where there's a constant tension between the editorial function and the business function, such as a magazine or a broadcasting network, that any opportunity passed up is wrong. I mean, I think if the publisher of a major New York not New York, but any city, a paper hires some relative or does something silly over the objection of the editor, people ought to scream and shout. I mean, why not? It seems to me that at the very least they should try to embarrass them. I don't think they're going to get fired for it.
Well, I remember screaming and shouting at Larry Tisch because I was standing on a picket line for 7 weeks,
right,
joining a lot of other people during,
right,
the Writers Guild strike. And it ended, and everybody's happy now, more or less. Well, I want to talk about if you can't say something nice, but, you know, I never really found out very much about you. Now, I do know that you were born in Kansas City, Missouri.
Right.
I learned how to say that right by reading your books, of course. What year were you born?
In 1935, in December 35.
That was a pretty good year then, wasn't it? Of course, you were in the middle of the
Dust
Bowl.
It was hard for me to tell. I was just a tiny baby.
All the sand blowing through the street.
Well, it's not really the Dust Bowl, Kansas City. It's a very sylvan place, really. Very beautiful.
What was it like growing up there?
It was very much like a Hollywood movie of growing up in a regular American city, or with high school and cheerleaders and...
Probably posed on a horse before a roving photographer.
I think there might be one or two pictures of me that I haven't found and burned that are on a horse.
Where'd you go to school?
You mean in Kansas City? I just went to the public schools of Kansas City, and then I went to Yale.
What did your parents do?
My father was a grocer, and he had read a book called Stover at Yale, and he thought that would be a... I suppose a heroic place.
Stover at Yale?
Stover
at Yale. Frank Merriwell at Yale.
No, I don't know whether Frank Merriwell was at Yale or not, but it was that sort of book. Stover at Yale was the kind of turn of the century, come in and save the game, last man tapped by the society, and It was in that genre. There's no question about that. But it wasn't Frank Merriwell. It was Dink Stover was his name.
Dink Stover.
Dink Stover.
We don't,
right,
use that name anymore.
We use it at Yale a lot, I think.
So he would come to you with this book, Stover at Yale?
No, he never did. I never actually saw the book.
Oh.
No, he was too shrewd for that.
But he imparted his enthusiasm for the school.
Well, I knew he wanted me to go there, I mean, from the time I was born.
And study medicine or something?
No. No, I don't. He wasn't really pushing about what to study.
What did you study?
Well, I majored in English. I mean, it was, it was a liberal arts
college.
What
did you plan to do with that degree?
I didn't know at all. I was in the time that people spoke of not knowing what they wanted to do when they grow up, and I certainly didn't know. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to be a neurosurgeon or a mechanic or a businessman. That I would probably have something to do with words rather than the numbers or manual skills. But that's about as far as it went, I think.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
Not necessarily. My father was a great reader, but he read pretty much everything pretty much indiscriminately. I mean, he read books that you would think of as good books and books that you'd think of as junk. And he was a kind of a stubborn man. And if he started a book, he finished it, no matter what it was. So he read a lot, but it certainly wasn't a literary household. Neither of my parents went to college.
Did you have some inkling when you were growing up in Kansas City that you might be a writer?
I don't think so. I think Well, I mean, I could write, I could write a speech or write an English paper, but I think I was required in the whole time I was in school in Kansas City to write perhaps one English paper or two. I mean, I never was, it wasn't the sort of education where you were constantly called on to demonstrate your abilities as a writer. So I wasn't one of those people who thought, someday I will grow up to be a writer and I'm sitting off to the side taking notes or anything like that. I think most people my age who were whatever we are, in journalism or something like that, kind of wandered into it. I don't think very many of us had the thought when we were kids that we were going to do it.
What happened after Yale?
I was in the Army. I had a kind of a quirk job with Time. I had worked at Time in the summers, and I had a kind of a quirk job with Time while I was waiting to go in the Army.
Quirk?
I mean, quirk. I mean, in a sense, it was not a permanent job. I mean, I worked there for the summer, and a guy said, do you want to come to work here? And I said, not really. I thought I'd go to Europe for a while. And he said, well, maybe we can arrange something there. So I worked for, I think it was the deal was I was going to work there for 6 months. And then I was in the Army. And then I went to Time, although not as an extension of that job, which was just kind of a temporary job. But I went there and went to the Atlanta Bureau of Time for about a year, covering the South. And then I came back here and was a writer at Time for, well, first I was in the New York Bureau for about 6 months, and then I was a writer for about a year, about half a year of in National Affairs, and the first half of the year as what was then called at Time a floater, somebody who went from section to section. And then in 63 I went to the New Yorker, and I've been there ever since.
Was there a cultural clash when you move from Time to the New Yorker? They're so radically different, aren't they?
Well, they're different mainly in that Time is the sort of place where you can't do your job during a week without meeting 35 different people. I mean, it's a real group operation. And the New Yorker is a place where you wouldn't even have to come into the office if you didn't want to. And so I think internally was much more of a change than anything else, that I was used to getting there on whenever it was Tuesday morning and having the story conference and having the conference with the researcher and talking to the senior editor and the kind of rhythm of a news magazine life. And the New Yorker was pretty much you went off and did your piece or did it there if you wanted to, and at some point came in and handed it to somebody. It isn't an unusual, I mean, there are a lot, over the years, there have been a lot of people who have gone back and forth. I think of the people there at the New Yorker now, I think only John McPhee came from Time. But Calvin Tompkins came from Newsweek. I think Winthrop Sargent had come from Time or Life. And over the John Hersey had worked from there. There have been a number of people who have done it.
Well, it's too bad. You missed Kelso Sutton. You know, he's over there now.
He left before you. I think I might have missed him anyway, even if I had been
there.
He's
kind of hard to miss, I understand, right. Actually. Well, now, of course, your stories and articles have appeared in the New Yorker and, of course, in The Nation. And you have put together, is this your third volume of
columns? This is the third volume of columns, and this is the first one that's mainly King Features syndicated weekly columns from that I did for newspapers. About the first dozen of them are ones that I did for The Nation.
Even though you do write columns for The Nation, your articles certainly seem to be non-ideological.
Well, my politics I'm opposed to whoever's in. And I don't like the opposition either. But I think in The Nation now, I mean, I write for them in the sense that they take this column.
You pay them for this?
They pay me a tiny bit. It turns out that once I went to syndication, I realized that they're pretty good payers, The Nation, because syndication pay is based on the circulation of the paper or what sort of market it is, I suppose they would say. And it can be very small. I mean, small, like $11 or something like that. So the nation at what we call now a C-note, you know, their original offer was they said they were thinking of paying me somewhere in the high two figures, but they eventually, when I turned it over to my high-powered literary agent, Robert Slowly Lesher, and said, play hardball, he got them up to 100, so I was being paid 100, or century, we call it sometimes. That's pretty good money in circulation, in syndication business. They still do that, but they do it, they only run it every 3 weeks. They're allowed to buy it on the spot basis. It's a arrangement open only to former exploiters of the author.
Well, does Nevasky ever get angry? He sees one of your columns and decides not to run it, you know, the way they do Doonesbury. You know, some paper doesn't like what they're saying, so they kill the comic for that week or month or day.
I don't think so. Of course, I don't make fun of him now anymore, and I'm because he wouldn't mean anything to most of the people who read the column, and he's really only one of the of management, and I wouldn't make fun of him without getting everybody else, and I guess I write less about people like Harold the Committed, who I wrote about a lot when I was doing it only for the Nation. Because I think of Harold the Committed as being mainly the nation's subscribers or their old subscribers, and I didn't think they should be able to get away scot-free reading these little jabs at Reagan or the Republicans. So I do less of that, but I think he picks out one column out of three, or somebody does it over there, and usually they pick out the more political one, but it's not necessarily having anything to do with their politics. And I must say, they did also run one of the columns I wrote about subscription cards recently, about sending in those subscription cards you see in magazines. You see them in magazines, including The Nation and The New Yorker.
Does it always fall out when you open them?
Sometimes they fall out. Sometimes they just keep you from reading what you want to read because they stay in, and you have to tear them out. And I wrote a column about trying to look on the positive side of this and realizing that the people in the circulation fulfillment departments, as they're called, or circulation fulfillment companies that process these cards, have a terrible, dreary job and have to decipher all of this scrawling and are in constant danger of paper cuts. And I saw the cards, which say right on them, no postage necessary if mailed in the United States, as a way to cheer them up. So I sent them in with little messages like, keep up the good work, circulation fulfillment people, that sort of thing. And I think The Nation ran one of those, to their credit. I don't think they ran all of them, but I did it in two or three columns, but I think at least one of them ran in The Nation.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the points that you raise, and if you can't say something nice. For example, on page 11, you talk about the motto maker's art, and you have some very good mottos that could certainly apply to a few politicians, not many, but a few, such as the one Never Been Indicted. Well, now tell me how this came about.
Well, Never Been Indicted was originally composed, if I may use that word, about a motto as a political slogan for somebody running for mayor of Buffalo. I thought Never Been Indicted was a tremendous slogan. And then later, it turned out it was used, in effect, by Ed Meese to become confirmed attorney general. And I was a little surprised that it would be used for somebody to become the chief law enforcement officer of the country. But they say that if a political slogan is really good, it's good for two or three usings. So I don't really begrudge him the motto.
I don't think he's going to have the chance to use that motto again.
Well, if that's the case, he can adopt a kind of a fallback motto I have, which is hardly ever been indicted. I think that might be the one that Ed Meese is going to have to use at his next job, although I don't know what that's going to be.
Well, it probably won't be in the White House. Well, you talk about Fred's 50th, and you mention, in fact, you have several mentions of the American Polled Hereford Association.
Sure.
T-shirt.
Yeah, that's my standard 50th birthday gift, or 40th or 60th. It's if there's a word called something like decadal or something like that, having to do with decades, that's my birthday gift. I usually, when I'm back home, I go out to the American Poultry Herford Association headquarters and stock up on those, and also sometimes the pen and pencil set. They have a different motto. I think they have a motto about, I can't quite remember. It's a different motto than, I like the motto on the T-shirts, which is, Poultry Herford's an American idea since 1901. And I also stop by Stroud's Fried Chicken Restaurant when I'm in Kansas City because they have a wonderful shirt. They have Stroud's pan-fried chicken crest on the front of it. On the back, their motto is a brilliant motto, we choke our own chickens. I think it's one of the great Kansas City restaurant mottos, although I still favor a motto that Winstead's Hamburger Stand used to have and doesn't seem to use anymore, your drinks are served in sanitized glasses. I used to like that as a motto.
The feeling of comfort and knowing that your health is going to be preserved.
That's right. And I like, as a general food motto for packaged food, I like the motto of Diefenbach's potato chip in Womelsdorf, Pennsylvania, a very fine local potato chip. His motto is, do not expose to sunshine. I think that's a first-rate motto. So these things are used everywhere, including, obviously, political administrations. I mean, this administration, I think, was really looking for a motto and floated a few mottos to see how people would react for the second term. I actually wanted to use a nice, short, snappy motto that uses the Roman numerals in the way the Super Bowl does, Voodoo 2. I thought that would have been an excellent motto. The very few administrations end up with usable mottos, as you've probably noticed. I think after the New Deal, and the Great Society was a truly awkward motto because you couldn't say it without acknowledging that it was. I mean, it had a judgment of it built into the motto, which meant that people couldn't really use it because they couldn't talk about it. The Carter administration tried a little trial balloon on a motto, a new foundation. And
that sounds like something Isaac Asimov would have written.
Well, it oddly enough was a motto our family had turned down as a family motto when families around our block started using mottos. The Johnsons put underneath their name on the mailbox a triumph in group therapy, and the Bernsteins on their station wagon said, the Bernsteins, the best mixed marriage yet.
They probably had a little crest, too, to go
yeah.
with these mottos.
And our family, we thought about a new foundation, but I come from the sort of people who have a morbid fear of underpinnings, and when I saw that motto, a new foundation, all I could think of was some beady-eyed contractor shaking his head and saying, I'm afraid what you're going to need here, pal, is a whole new foundation. So we went back to the motto my family had when I was a kid, which is zip up your jacket. I think that's a good motto.
Especially in the Midwest in the winters.
Absolutely.
You realize, don't you, that most people don't know what the American Poultry Herford Association is, at least not around here? And you never really make that clear.
I'm horrified and shocked. I mean, I thought it was common knowledge of the sort that these people are always talking about in these books that now are on the top of the bestseller list, telling Americans how dumb they are. I would think that that's in the everybody's body of knowledge, and I would assume that the guys who write the books about how dumb Americans are either know it or would acknowledge that they're not so smart either.
But you have to realize most Americans don't read.
Well, you didn't have to read to know about Poultry Herford. There was a mutation in 1901, and out of that mutation came a line of Herfords that varied from normal Herfords, or what the American Herford Association people would call real Herfords, because there's some rivalry among these breeds. They look like Herfords, but they don't have any horns. That's what polled means. They don't have any horns. And, Don, I'm really surprised that someone of your erudition didn't know that.
Well, I should have known that coming from Kansas. However, I have been east for so many years that I've tried to put a lot of this out of my mind. So probably I knew it, but I've suppressed it.
You were not able to draw it up from what do they call that? Something, these kind of collective literacy, factual literacy, historical literacy. And I'm surprised at that. I suppose you probably don't even know about the bull on a pylon next to the American Hereford Association headquarters, also in Kansas City, 50 feet high, the pylon, and a bull whose heart and liver light up at night. You didn't know about that either?
That sounds like a lovely sight.
It's gorgeous.
They ought to, you know, if they could mount that on some sort of vehicle so that it could tour. You know, I could
It'd be pretty hard to get off the building, I think. In fact, the American Hereford Association sold the building because with computers, as you probably know, Don, the basic functions of breed associations are to promote the breed and to keep track of registration of all these animals. And with computers, they need a lot fewer people to do that, so they didn't need this huge building, and they sold it. And there was some fear in Kansas City that the new owners would not keep the cow or the bull. And when I read about it, in fact, I suggested to my wife that it might be a nice idea for us to bring it to New York and put it on top of our house in the village. And if the landmark preservation people said anything about it, we would just say, well, it was there when we got the house. I'm surprised you all didn't notice it.
Well, the Lone Star Cafe used to have an iguana or something on the
roof. I think they've put it back.
Didn't they?
There was some argument among the neighbors about it. And in fact, the wily and parsimonious Victor Navasky, the editor of The Nation, can look out of his window onto the iguana, and even when they had it hidden behind the parapet, he could view the iguana.
It's a lovely sight.
That is what really has inspired him, I think. And that's why when people say that when it comes to paying writers, he's like some sort of reptile, I think that's really what it comes from.
Well, we don't have too much more time, Calvin, but I did want to cover a couple of other points, and if you can't say something nice. And this is one in which I fully agree with you on, and because I never learned how to use it right. So I never say whom. And you go into some detail about the use of whom. Tell me about
that. Yeah, I think whom is a word that was invented to make everybody sound like a butler. It's a stupid word. Nobody's ever said it without feeling slightly odd about it. And when you think of some of the great quotes of the English language, Ross Barnett, who recently died, was a governor of Mississippi, and he let a trustee from the prison, his warden let a trustee from the prison go take some horses to Missouri, and the trustee didn't come back, and there was quite a bit of criticism. And old Ross said, well, if you can't trust a trustee, who could you trust? Now, what if he said, whom can you trust? That would be really stupid. Or what if you just sat there in some bar, the sort of bar that gets kind of rowdy late in the evening, and you looked over at the guy next to you and said, whom do you like in the series? That would really brand you as this sort of nerd that shouldn't be in the bar.
You'd get a beer over the forehead.
That's right. You might really get hurt. So I think we should just all agree to get rid of it. Don't just quit using it. And all these strict language guys would cave in. Look how quickly caved in on hopefully, used incorrectly. They do the same thing on who and whom.
Well, I gave up whom a long time ago because I always got it wrong. So I figured I'd just standardize my English and just say who. And nobody's complained.
That is more or less what I'm suggesting.
Now, the chicken a la king question. Whatever happened to chicken a la king?
Well, that's what I bring up in this piece. The country used to be awash in chicken a la king. And as a reporter going around the country, I spent a lot of time in Kiwanis luncheons, where they always started the luncheon singing the Kiwanis song, I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club. Invariably, they served chicken a la king. And I even made up a verse of the Kiwanis song dealing with chicken a la king. There's nothing can defeat us, whatever life may bring, because we can go and eat us some chicken a la king. Oh, I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club. And it was a cross-cultural, socio-economic dish. If you went to a really fancy debutante party, which, being Stover at Yale, I did because my roommate, Thatcher Baxter Hatcher, would occasionally take me to one of these events. Very late in the evening, a very snooty-looking man in a tuxedo would come out with a huge silver bowl, and inside the bowl was chicken a la king. In fact, one of the theories about why those North Shore Society people talk the way they do without opening their mouths, you know, they all talk like this, is that that goop the chicken a la king floats in, particularly if it has been allowed to react chemically with silver, tends to bond the teeth together. Bond your upper teeth to your lower teeth, not bond your teeth to somebody else's teeth. And there's one theory that that's why they talk that way. So it was all over the place. We don't know what happened to it, but when I'm going across the prairies and I see some of those big government storage silos, you see three or four of them usually in a cluster. I figure one of them's full of chicken a la king, the other one's up to the lid with beef stroganoff, and the other one has something like Nehru jackets, something like that.
Well, there is another endangered food species that you really should think about. I hope that you'll do something on that in the future. Turkey divan. Remember turkey divan?
Nanu, do I remember it. It was Trish Nixon's favorite recipe. That's probably what happened to it. Trish used to put out the recipe in Republican cookbooks. And the only thing I remember about the recipe, I don't cook myself, so I don't ordinarily read recipes, but it consisted of pouring a couple of cans of chicken soup over a poor bird that was a chicken already. And I don't know what else they did to it.
Well, they would put toast on the bottom and usually asparagus or broccoli on top of that. And then they would put the turkey. And then the top would be like cheese.
Well, may I ask you what I suppose seems a really simple question. If it had turkey in it, how come they called it chicken divan? Why wouldn't they call it turkey divan?
Well, it could be made both ways.
Oh, I see.
I recall the turkey divan. I guess it can be chicken divan.
Trish Nixon's recipe was definitely chicken divan, or to use the French pronunciation, divan.
Divan, yes. Well, probably she made it on a regular basis, and turkey is special. She probably only made turkey divan like once a year.
That's right. That's right, on Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah, I remember my mother would take me shopping to the largest department store, Foley's in Houston, Texas, usually on Fridays, and I would always get the turkey divan special. Of course, that was in 1946, and I haven't had it since. I've been looking for it, but I never see it on a menu.
Well, you probably should go to a Republican fundraiser somewhere, and you would find it.
Yeah, but there aren't any Republican fundraisers in New York.
Oh. Well, you'll probably have to go back to the Midwest or Houston or somewhere.
Go back to Wichita.
Wichita definitely has Republican fundraisers.
Probably have chicken a la king there, too.
It
get
may
out
be,
of the grain silos.
Well, that's right, because they have it all right there. All they have to do is just go over to one of the silos and turn on the tap. It's kind of like having Schlitz on tap for them.
Well, Calvin, we're almost out of time. I did want to discover about one or two other points. You have one column in which you devote to your life in poetry. Now, I think this is extremely important to talk about because poetry certainly says with words all the things that we couldn't say otherwise.
Well, I think poetry is a fine form, and what I really was hoping to do was to write a sort of kind of resume, hoping to be chosen poet laureate. I mean, I wasn't trying to push aside Robert Penn Warren. In fact, I think I wrote a poem when he became poet laureate, which was, "Who has talent, the sort of talent at poetry that is scarcer than the tooth of a hen, Robert Penn." That was a poem I wrote for him, so I certainly didn't mean any disrespect, but it was the sort of job where they said it was only for a year or two. So I wrote several poems. I wrote a poem about mimes. I think one of the verse was, it was called "Nobody Really Likes Mime." Nobody knows what they're saying. Nobody knows what they're saying. Egg-laying, something-aying. Paying, if they're paying somebody a peso to sell them some chili con queso, why don't they simply just say so? Nobody really likes mime. That's one of the mime poems. I wrote a poem about called Smokin' Fish, Just Ain't My Dish, I Want to Be a Star. It's about a fish smoker who wanted to be a country music star. I remember a couplet from there. In a roadside dump, this country cracker will be better off than smoking mackerel. So I write on a really wide range of subjects.
Writing poetry certainly singles you out as, I mean, a lot of people say sometimes, I know you did Killings and all of that, and you've written in a lot of important pieces, but some people, because of your humor columns, don't take you all that seriously. So I suppose...
My wife and daughters are among them.
But with the poetry, the more poetry you write, such as some of the examples you just gave me, certainly that image should change.
Oh, I would think so. And not only that, I do country songs, too. I think the only one mentioned in this book is a country song called Too Many Long Neck Bottles, Too Many Redneck Men. But I don't think it has words in it. But in one of the novels, I wrote a lot of country songs, such as I Ain't Bowling in Your Bowling League No More, and These Coveralls You See May Be Green, But I'm the Bluest Car Mechanic You Ever Seen. A number of, I think, hit songs.
Well, I would think so. Of course, writing country songs doesn't take too much of an effort. I would certainly...
I've written also songs in Nova Scotia, where we live in the summer. I wrote a song called If There's No Nova Scotia in Nova Scotia, There Can't Be Any French Fries in France. Now, that was more of a, I would say, Broadway sort of song.
Yeah, that's...
A little higher level than country.
More like Stephen Sondheim stuff.
Well, yeah, Sondheim-esque, if that's the word.
Well, a few years ago when you were in, and this, I guess, was another edition of Uncivil Liberties, we talked about your proposal for spaghetti carbonara for Thanksgiving Day dinner, and I thought that was a great idea. I ran the piece on the air, and I had at least three telephone calls from irate people who thought that this was a religious gaffe. It was sacrilege. And they could not understand how I could put such a proposal on the air. It was just a complete outrage.
I mean, they have some kind of religion that's based on turkey?
I don't know. But I can tell you this, at least
the only thing kosher in their religion is turkey?
Three people, at least, called.
You were swamped by three calls?
I was swamped with three calls that week to demand why I would put such an outrageous proposal on the air. So I wanted to find out, it's been some years since you made that proposal, what sort of reaction you've had, and if we're closer to adopting spaghetti carbonara for Thanksgiving.
I don't think that we can talk yet about a bandwagon effect, but I think a lot of people have joined the crusade, and a lot of people understand that the people who were the pilgrims here may or may not have had turkey. The only thing that we know about what they had is they couldn't have tasted very good. They were English people. They were from East Anglia, the most English part of England, where any well-brought-up young woman is still taught to boil the vegetables for at least 3 days in case one of the guests shows up without his teeth. So I think people are coming around a little bit. I mean, certainly the people who said to me, this is not what our ancestors ate, and I've always said to them that one of the things I give thanks for at Thanksgiving is that these people were not my ancestors. My people did not get here till this century, and we are not responsible for snookering the Indians out of anything. And we didn't slaughter any buffalo. We had nothing to do with slavery. We have a mild collateral responsibility for the First World War, but in our defense, I have to say that most of my family were draft dodgers. So I'm not really sure that we should be giving thanks for them. I think we should give thanks that we're not related to them. And I think spaghetti carbonara is the way to do it, because certainly that's what Columbus brought to the Indians.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and I think that you shouldn't give up on it, and I think every year you ought to make a new pitch. And
I like to do it once a year, at least on the air. It's kind of like the Queen's Christmas message in England. I like to go on at least once a year around Thanksgiving time and remind people that spaghetti carbonara would be the proper dish.
Calvin Trillin, well, I have other questions to ask you, but we've been chatting now for almost 50 minutes, so that would be unfair for me to keep you here any longer. It also gives me a lot more tape I'll have to cut and listen to. So I'm acting out of a certain degree of self-interest, but as always, it's fun to talk to you. And when are we going to have another big, important book like Killings?
Not within the week, I should say.
Next month?
Maybe next month. Wait quietly.
Calvin Trillin, thanks a million.
Thank you, Don.